Everyone struggles with self-doubt and motivation in their careers, especially us artists. That's why we started the Other 22 Hours podcast. I'm Aaron Schaefer-Hase. I'm a music producer and writer, and I've spent years on the road with tons of different bands.
And I'm Michaela Ann, a singer-songwriter who's put out half a dozen records both independently and with labels and toured all over the world. So we've lived these challenges and conversations ourselves.
Each episode is an artist-to-artist conversation with different musicians, be it Grammy winners like Mary Chapin Carpenter or the Milk Carton Kids, bands like Lucius or Maddie Diaz, songwriters like Lori McKenna, or even legacy artists like Rodney Crowell and Alice Gerard. Each one of them share the tools and routines they've found to stay sane, creative, and inspired while their livelihood is based on their art.
So whether you're an artist yourself or anyone with a passion for creative endeavors, these chats will leave you feeling more inspired, connected, and confident in your own creative journey.
The Other 22 Hours is available wherever you're listening to this podcast, and it's on YouTube. So go find your favorite episode today.
Hey there, it's Ismay. I am coming to you today from a tour van in Amarillo, Texas. I am on a tour to share Finding Lucinda in venues across the country. So every night I have been bringing together a group of special guests to play Lucinda Williams songs and play their own songs. And then after that, I've been screening Finding Lucinda, the documentary film. When this episode comes out, I think I will be in New Orleans, Louisiana, screening the film at New Orleans Film Festival, and then doing an event that same evening, October 27th, at Chickiwawa with a bunch of special guests. Once I do that New Orleans event, I'm going to be in Ann Arbor, Michigan, Fayetteville, Arkansas, Boston, New York City, Hudson Valley, Providence, Rhode Island, and then finally Chicago. So, the last episode you heard concluded the narrative arc of the original Finding Lucinda road trip journey. The story was titled Meeting Lucinda Williams. But I do have a couple more episodes to share with you on the podcast. These episodes are just about the making of the documentary. They're about the processes behind it and are interviews with those who were behind the scenes with me. Just a little explainer to make it make a little more sense. Finding Lucinda is a documentary film and this podcast. They are both derived from the same set of interviews and material. The podcast is a longer form version of the same story and obviously is simply an audio retelling. So it can get a little bit confusing, but they overlap and intertwine from the get-go, the podcast and the film. On this interview today that you're going to hear, I spoke with Chuck Prophet. He is an amazing singer-songwriter, and he was involved in Finding Lucinda, the project, from the very beginning. On October 12th, 2025, Chuck and I got together in Chico, California for a Finding Lucinda event. This chattering tape you're hearing in the background, that's from the audience as we talked and hung out at the Chico Women's Club. So the next morning after we did our wonderful event, we met up at a Marriott in Chico and sat down to talk about the making of Finding Lucinda from Chuck's perspective. You are listening to Finding Lucinda from the Bluegrass Situation. I hope you enjoy this episode. So I'm here with my friend, co-producer of the film, Chuck Prophet. Last night we played in Chico, California at the Chico Women's Club. And today we're at the Courtyard Marriott talking about the making of Finding Lucinda. So I think I'll just start with asking mostly about our process behind the scenes. And just tell people about what you remember about how we got started with this whole thing.
Well, I remember having lunch with your dad and you, of course, and that's when he pitched the idea of doing this, you know, movie about Lucinda's music and the fact that, you know, there was a family band called the Lake Charlatans who, and I thought, yeah, that could be a lot of things. And so I warned everybody that I had no experience with filmmaking or anything like that. And I remember your dad goes, yeah, I'm not worried about that, you know. Which I thought was kind of cool. Mm-hmm. And so, I'm reminded of something. When I think back on that, I'm reminded of producing records. And I don't produce records very often. When I do, I really kind of, get with the artist and become one with, their vision. And I really throw myself into it. Oftentimes I play, at least on the basic tracks, I remember talking to an artist and he was saying, when we get in there, it'll be, when we get in the studio, every time I had, a concern about something, I don't know about the bridge of the song, and the key seems a little low for your voice. Well, once we get in there, and I remember thinking, like, this is the fun part right now. I know that you think it's going to, you can't wait to get in there, and the all the lights dim, and like you're in a spaceship, and it's big speakers, and your voice has reverb on it and everything, but this is the fun part. If you can't enjoy this, I'm a little worried. Because we're thrashing around. Anything's possible. Any ideas are good. Put it all on the table. Who cares? And that's what it was like in those early days. Like, what if, I think we were talking about some place in Petaluma that was a big warehouse that had like a half pipe. And I'm like, yeah, we could be playing. And then behind us would be like these kids on the half pipe. Like there were just images that I had because I was really infatuated with, I think it's called Hail Hail Rock and Roll, which is a Chuck Berry movie that they filmed the rehearsals in Chuck Berry's old amusement park, which had fallen into disrepair. But at one time, like a lot of people, Dolly Land and things like that, Chuck Berry had an amusement park. It was called Berryland. And it was really run down, and the colors were kind of, 70s colors. And I remember thinking, oh, this is vibey, And they're in there, and Chuck's sitting playing on the couch, and Keith Richards is in there they're having an argument. And it's just really, the atmosphere I thought was really cool. And I thought, oh, we could film rehearsals or, whatever. And so that was the period of time that was really fun because anything was possible. And then some of these things, like visiting Malico Studios and visiting the Hole in the Wall in Austin, which is just dripping with vibe, a lot of those things did come together in the film, and I think Joel, the director, does have a gift for making things look cinematic. Even when you guys filmed just the first few scenes up in Sebastopol, is that where that is? Or up in
Petaluma.
Sonoma County, let's call it, yeah. There was just a real cinematic vibe to it. The sun was coming up and it was the golden hour and you were walking up that hill. Well, people who have seen the movie, they'll know what I'm talking about. So, yeah, that's what I remember about the early days.
Yeah, and I think my recollection is it started out as a movie that was intended to be kind of just be about the tribute band. I don't think we really knew what we were going to do at all. And you had that movie, Hail, Hail, Rock and Roll. I went up to a cabin on the Klamath River and just watched it on DVD. And then we worked through the idea, like, really organically. You reached out to Lucinda, kind of said, hey, we're working on this project. And then we just kind of decided, well, let's just start filming at the farm and see what happens. And I think over time, instead of being about the band, it kind of became about me, hesitantly on my part, but it became about the artistic journey and looking to Lucinda as an example. And you were kind of involved from every part of it. And my other biggest recollection of your involvement was the first edit of the film. We sat down in the barn and watched the movie, the very first version, which is very unlike the current version. Do you remember doing that?
I remember watching the first edit along with your husband, Andy, and we were all socially distanced, and we were in a barn watching a big screen television. It's kind of weird. And I remember we got to the end, and I think Andy broke the ice. He's like, where's the other Avery? You know, we're only really seeing one side of Avery. And he was like, it's just kind of dreary and humorless, you know. And I felt a little bit the same way. I mean, I had a lot of positive things to say, I'm sure. Let me start with what I like about it, you know. But yeah, I do remember that, and I do remember those were ultimately our notes.
So you've worked on a musical, Temple Beautiful, right?
Mm-hmm.
How does the process of making a musical and creating that story relate to your experience with making Finding Lucinda?
I don't know. I mean, there's just fundamentals to storytelling, you know? I mean, let's face it, you know. Something happened in pop culture, and one morning I woke up, everybody's a storyteller. My little sister has a sprinter. And she and her husband are empty nesters, and they like to go do things. And I was checking out their sprinter because I'm kind of interested in these things. You know, I'm still in the Econoline. I'm still in the 80s. And it's called the Storyteller.
That's the brand.
Yeah, that's the brand or something. I said, man, everybody's. You know, remember when cars were all like, you know, I don't know. Yeah, everybody's a storyteller these days. So whether it's the musical or whether it's your film or whether I'm on stage, you know, trying to keep people's interest for an hour and a half show or whatever. Yeah, what you want to do is you want to get to a place where people give a darn what happens next, you know? How do you do that? I don't know. You know it when it's there. You can hang out with theater nerds and they can tell you about conflict and conflict resolution and characters that are transformed or characters that aren't transformed, you know, or twinning where you have, you know, I mean, you can get all these things, and they use the word trope a lot, which was kind of a new word to me, and I think it gets used too much. But, yeah, so I don't know how, you know, writing this musical relates to filmmaking, but it's all the same stuff, really. I mean, this podcast is the same thing, you know. You're just trying to keep people engaged and keep it moving along so that they care, you know, what happens next. Mm-hmm. Give them a nice little cliffhanger. Does Avery, does she decide to pursue the life as an artist? Does she understand that, you know, that art is pain? Does she understand that art is adversity? She's probably getting an idea by now. Yeah.
So, like, what I hear you saying is there's all these storytelling training tactics. And, like, I was trained in storytelling structures, so I took a lot of classes on how do you structure a story. Sort of Star Wars is the classic story. Setting up the frame, setting up the stakes. But the cool thing that I hear what you're saying that I think you bring to art and creativity is you make sure to keep the intuitive side of it there. You don't, like, get too bogged down in concepts like tropes or concepts like stakes. You're really coming to art and music from a place of, like, how does this make me feel? And I think that's a powerful characteristic to bring in. And that's why maybe people enjoy collaborating with you, is because you're not like, well, let's look at the percentage of this that sounds like that, you know?
But I'm not like, you know, I'm not willfully ignorant. Mm. You know what I mean? I want to know. I'm happy to learn, and what I do know about music and what I did learn from, you know, I had limited guitar lessons as, like, when I was 12. I mean, I did learn some basic theory, you know, hey, this is a triad, this is what makes a major chord, this is what makes a minor, the other place, the other weird note, that's usually a seventh or a sixth or something, you know, so you learn a little bit of theory, and then this helped me to communicate with other musicians, you know. There's also the other school of thought, which is equally valid, and that is the what Jim Dickinson calls GBUs. And we might be talking about bars or measures or things, but GBUs are garage band units. But, you know, I mean, if you get together with musicians and you can't communicate, what you're hearing or what you want, that's a little bit of a problem. It's kind of a bummer for people, mm-hmm. If you can't do that. So I think it's cool to learn some music theory, and it'll serve you well, even if it's just garage band units.
You don't want to ignore the fact there's a lot of people that can convey some really helpful strategies that you don't want to just be like, well, I don't care about theory at all. I'm the same way when it comes to music
theory.
Yeah,
you don't want to be willfully ignorant. You know what I mean? Like, okay, we're all self-taught. We all figured out how to do it. You can put a little effort into it.
Yeah, exactly. You don't want to be willfully ignorant. And sometimes there's one person in a band that gets to be that, but the rest of us have to.
Usually the lead singer.
Usually the lead singer. I'm curious, when it comes to the process of making this documentary, what were you surprised about during the process? What surprised you?
Well, I was surprised that that Joel was able to find this story, which was your personal journey and your, insecurities and a lot of things that a lot of us have experienced. And that way, for better or worse, the film had emotion. And that's what we're after, ultimately, is we're after emotion. I mean, are we feeling anything here? Are we going someplace we haven't really been before? See, a lot of documentaries, there's the behind the music, whatever. Everybody knows there's a format to that, a structure. They hook you in the first, they throw a conflict at you, and the band gets back together. There's drug, whatever. So it really works until it doesn't anymore, because you're like, oh, I've seen like 8 of these. Are all these the same? And then they just kind of go away. So I mean, he was really going for something that I didn't really see. So that was surprising, but in many ways, it makes the movie original in many respects. And there's a lot of rock docs and things out there, and they feel like something you've seen before. They don't take you anywhere fresh, And that's the thing about, music and. I think it helps to be a fan. I think it helps to listen to music and listen to what's out there. Go see movies. If you're a filmmaker, I imagine you want to go see movies so that you can know whether or not what you're doing is fresh mm-hmm. out there to people.
It's interesting to hear that it was surprising for you to learn about Joel's kind of vision with the story. And I think I was prepared for the story to go in that direction. I was sort of in a place of understanding, that you kind of need, like you said, something to motivate the film forward. And I think, in my experience, some people have been surprised because they're like, well, I thought this was just about Lucinda Williams. And it's not really the point of the movie to be purely about her. But I think, to me, I'm just more interested in like human stories, the human emotion, the human experience behind it. It was a propellant. This question that I started out with of, am I good enough to make this worth doing, really propelled the story forward and made the reason for looking towards Lucinda have something behind it, something tangible behind it. And so I think it's sort of an interesting crossover. It's not just a music documentary, and it's not just like a regular, human story documentary. It's kind of a melding of the two. And I have a question. So, one of the things that I'm excited about right now is I always think about, how do you approach art as a musician? How do you approach being creative as a career from a more like, outside the box format. And that's sort of been working for a lot of people. You know, what comes to mind is that guy who started Patreon, so he's in a band, was in a band, and he sort of didn't just play music, but he was sort of like, I want to start these artist communities to support other artists. So he was like a multidimensional artist. And that's what's kind of interested me about making this film, is I can come to these venues and do a little songwriter round like we did last night, and then show the film. And I think I'm like able to give people an experience that I'm excited to curate. That's very, it's sort of intellectual, it's sort of contemplative, and it fits in with my personality. Mm. But I'm curious, like, how do you think about presenting your music in a way that gets people engaged, or maybe thinks outside the box a little bit?
Well, we're talking about a couple different things. I mean, when we talk about people that, you know, are talented musicians, and they start something like Patreon, they have other talents, you know. I think, you know, what I do is I try to make records. Well, if I'm lucky enough to have a batch of songs I'm excited about, you know, then I want to do my best to get those songs to be a record, you know. And that's its own, you know, struggle. And getting those songs to behave and wrestling it all the way to the ground and remixing it, and, you know. And then if I care enough about it, I want to go out and do the hand-to-hand combat, take the songs to the people, take it out. And so, you know, for me, I just happen to be, you know, my medium is guitars and drums, you know. That's kind of my medium, and it's what I know, and it's what I'm good at, you know. So you know, I've a lot of what I've done has really been a bar band, you know, going out there and playing. And I remember in the early days I knew we were doing something right. One of the first indications that I felt like we were doing something right was when a sound man or a bartender would say, like, oh yeah, you guys were here before. That was really cool. When I saw you on the calendar, I signed up to bartend. You know, oh, okay. So, yeah. All right, we're doing something, you know. The bartenders are jaded, you know. I mean, Steve Martin, in his book called Born Standing Up, I think he talks about his whole journey as a stand-up comedian, you know, and how initially he was doing stuff that was very much under the influence of other people, and even a book of jokes that he'd had. He was a magician, and you know, he did okay, but he couldn't seem to get to that quote unquote next level. footnote Mary Gaucher. And so yeah, and so Steve Martin at one point became so disillusioned that he decided, I'm just going to throw out anything in my act that's overtly influenced or that I borrowed or that I tweaked a little. I'm going to throw all of it out. And he got into this thing where he would do stuff that was really abstract. And he was just, he was sinking, you know. He was just, it wasn't working. And then he stuck with it, and then he began to notice something. The waitresses were giggling. Hmm. You know, they were coming through the crowd and bringing people their 2-drink minimum, and giggling, and he was getting laughs from the staff, and that really, what that indicated was, they've heard everything, and they're like, this guy's really funny. You know what I mean? And they were the audience, really, that you want to, it's not the tourists that got, you know, they were down Union Square and somebody shoved a coupon into their hands, you know. No, these are the people that, you know, you're on to something. Mm-hmm. And so I always felt like when the sound guys and the bartenders and, you know, would come to our shows, I thought, you know, we're on to something. I mean, just got to feed and water this. And that's really what it's been, you know. And of course, there were times when we got breaks, you know, like Lucinda Williams early on took us out on tour and introduced us to her audience, and was very generous about, you know, pumping us up, and it went a long way. You know, she's a tastemaker. So yeah, that's the, but I don't really feel like I'm doing anything that's out of the box in that way, you know, in terms of, oh no, you know, we played on the back of a pickup truck, and you know, I can't think of anything like that in particular.
Out of the box. I mean, I think what you said about you're in the club and the bartender want to come see the show. Like a memory comes to my mind when I was working on the film. I was playing this showcase at Americana Fest, and there was like 40 artists or whatever. It was like tons and tons of people each playing like two songs, maybe 20, but it was a lot. And I remember I was at the merch table afterwards, and somebody from one of the other bands came up, and we were chatting, and I was like, oh yeah, and I'm doing this sort of road trip documentary about tracing Lucinda Williams' roots, and this person's eyes lit up. And they were like, oh, wow, and they were excited to talk to me. I mean, of course, you want to touch people with your music, and they were excited about the music, but it was interesting to see how sometimes the doors can open with this project. I feel like when you can break through the wall that people have up, oh, another sad singer-songwriter,
yeah.
You know?
I mean, I've seen a lot of dreary stuff out there that just kind of, you know, why is it that a songwriter is supposed to play an acoustic guitar and have a capo, and then why, you know, why don't we talk about people like Peaches, you know, Canadian electro clash artist who uses like a drum machine and a Casio tone, and she just writes great songs, you know, phenomenal songs. Where we don't talk about Jinx Lennon, guy from Ireland that you know, plays a Casio and even runs around with a bullhorn. I mean, he just has really great songs, and there are so many ways to express yourself, but this is the uniform of the songwriter, mm-hmm. you know. And when I see people breaking that mold, you know, I get excited. You know, there's a lot of this this school of songwriting where people talk about, you know, you got to do the work and doing the work, and I'm like, these guys, you know, these guys, they didn't fight in the freaking Civil War, you know. I mean I've rewritten songs for 10 years, you know. And they got better. I've rewritten songs over years, and they didn't get better. You know, so I don't know what to tell you. You know, I mean, I can subscribe to all of this stuff, you know, in any school of thought. But it's interesting how you know we've come to believe that that's the way a singer songwriter, you know, that's how you present yourself, and that's a pity, because we should be rewarding people who are out of the cage or out of the box or out of the, you know, choose your, and I'd like to see more of that.
So you touched briefly a minute ago on opening for Lucinda on tour. I'd like you to just kind of set the scene, like, what were you up to? What was the scene like? And then tell me a little bit about the tour, maybe the tour bus.
Well, what was the scene? Well, I guess it was 2002. Up to that point, I'd been making records with my wife, Stephanie, you know, singing harmony. We kind of were inspired by, in the early days, a lot by Graham and Emmy Lou and Bob and Emmy Lou and everybody in Emmy Lou. And, you know, I was making these records for British labels. But mostly what we did was we toured the UK and Europe. And because I was in Green on Red and I was known over there, I suppose that was where we had a footing, you know, something to feed and water, and plus the labels were over there. So North America, you know, we might go to Austin and play, you know, and we had friends there and stuff, but North America was pretty vast, and my strategy in terms of North America was like, if we ignore it long enough, it just might go away. And it didn't, you know. And so eventually I signed to a fledgling new label called New West. And, you know, it was around that time that I started hearing stuff on the radio, or I started thinking, well, you know, what am I going to do? Am I going to make a Down in the Dumps Americana record? Or, you know, what am I going to do exactly? So, and so I started writing with the drum machine, you know, at home and on my four track. And I was working a crappy job, and I don't know, I was about fucking 8 records into doing this, you know, game. And I started recording these little things on my four track, and one of them was a song that I called Summertime Thing, which I just wrote at the top of the page. I never really had it. I thought I would have a title later. And I kind of dug it, you know, and there was something about it that it just had that kind of thing that made me want to return to it. It's very simple, you know, but something about the chocolate and the peanut butter together, you know, had something about it. And then I showed it to some musicians. I was making some demos. And as soon as we started playing it, everybody was wagging their tails and got all happy, you know. And so I included that song on this album, No Other Love, and we did a couple things at radio. And, yeah, and something happened, you know. K-Fog started playing it in the Bay Area. And, you know, KGSR in Austin, and some of these other, The Point and The River and the, you know, these kind of. And so that was the summer that Lucinda took us out on tour. And, you know, I remember, like, we were in Philadelphia or something, and I was in some place, like, getting a salad bar or something, and I could hear it coming out of the speakers in the store, you know. And I thought, oh, this is pretty cool, you know. And so that's where we were at, and Lucinda took us out on tour. She was very generous. The fees were low, and sometimes I learned later that if the fee was, their budget was really low for the opening act, I learned later that Lucinda was pitching in a little bit to make it more doable for us. And yeah, we were driving around in a Econoline van, 5-piece band, trying to keep up with Lucinda's bus. And yeah, it was kind of a magical summer. She had been a fan of my previous record. I had a song on there called Dying All Young, which had some beats, and I knew that she was into that, and that's all I really knew. You know, I got to know her a little bit over the summer, and one of the things that I think back on now is that while we were trying to keep up with her bus, which could be challenging because of the routing for the tour, eventually, me and the band, who we were road managing ourselves, you know, we'd be having our dinner, you know, after the sound check. And we'd be like, look, man, we got to get all the way to Baltimore. We need to, like, carve off a few hours tonight, you know. Why don't we load our stuff after we're done opening? Why don't we just load our stuff off the stage, ride into the van, and, you know, maybe go 2 or 3 hours towards our next destination? And everybody, yeah, let's do that. We're going to do that. Oh, yeah, we're going to do that. And this happened a number of times, you know, and ultimately she'd be doing her encore, and where is everybody? And we'd be ducked behind the monitor board watching the show, and we just saw 20 shows. But we were just all so enamored with her. And she was playing Sweet Side, you know, John Coltrane, Fruits of My Labor, and I may have the titles wrong, but just great songs that were not recorded at the time. And I went on an overnight trip with her, so, and we talked about music, and I brought some records, and we listened to music, and I remember we listened to Jimmy Reed, and she was a great host, and she made a pot of half decaf coffee, which I totally appreciated. And then, there were other times, Steffi and I, you know, a few years later, we played a festival together in Seattle, and Steffi and I socialized with Tom and Lucinda on her bus after the gig, and I was very, very touched that Lucinda, like, put some potato chips in a bowl, you know, like your grandma might do. And we all had our sodas and potato chips, and we all adore Lucinda, you know, personally as well as, you know, her artistry. And that's another thing I can talk about all day. And that's one of the things I wanted to ask you is, I think it's interesting that Lucinda's first record was all covers. And I really believe that there's something to soaking in the work of others, you know, and using it as a frame to insert your own sensibilities, you know. What I know about songwriting, I came from probably learning other songs more than anything. And I want to know for you whether or not learning Lou's song has helped to put some tools in your toolbox, songwriting toolbox, and if so, like, what are those?
So, I mean, I think on a more sort of holistic level, I learned from Lucinda's story and Leonard Cohen's story about how they actually had this origin in the world of poetry. They were both somewhat or deeply trained in poetry before they became songwriters. And I definitely learned from the poetry side, but in terms of very tangible things, I think back to the interview with Mary Gaucher where she was talking about how when she wrote Mercy Now, which is like her most well-known song, she looked directly to Lucinda's song Change the Locks. And so her theory that she applied from Change the Locks is you sort of start small and then you move the camera back. You change the locks on my front door, and then you eventually go from that to change the kind of car I drive. I change the kind of clothes I wear. And then I change the name of this town. And she did that with Mercy Now, where she's kind of talking her father, her brother, then she goes to My Church and Country. So that's a really specific songwriting / poetry writing strategy, is imagine yourself as a camera that's zooming out. And another huge piece that I think I learned about in her songwriting is how she uses pretty straightforward chords, yet she might modify, like, maybe one chord is a little unexpected, but it's not every chord in the song that's totally wonky. She's still doing 1/4/5s. And to try to figure out how to write a song that feels familiar yet is completely unique is sort of the aspiration of myself as a songwriter, and I think many songwriters. It's not super hard to be like, I'm going to make an album made out of the sound of cats getting their teeth brushed. It's like, that's weird, and you can push that boundary without thinking too hard.
That's interesting because I often think of what makes the listener hear the song, like in the case of Lucinda, is the simplicity of the music. Mm-hmm. You know, you got people like Paul McCartney, who is, you know, he's got these more ornate melodies, like, what's he saying? What, you know what I mean? And then, you know, John Lennon, hey, you got to hide your, you know, and it's so direct, and it's not because he's not melodic, you know. It's just that, you know, when Lucinda toggles those one chord to the four chord, you know, G to C or whatever, and sings Sweet Side, you know, there's a reason why it works so well, and that's part of her intelligence, you know, that she kept the music simple. And that's how we hear the words, you know. Mm-hmm. And so that's, you know, part of her gift, I think.
Yeah, and when I was starting the Lucinda Williams tribute band with my dad, the music I was writing was much more like Songs from a Room, Leonard Cohen, as very sort of maybe not super rhythmic, not super country influenced. And I played these 3-hour gigs with my dad in these bars, singing Lucinda Williams songs, trying to internalize them. And I think I became much better at rhythm and groove. I don't think that was necessarily the first thing I jumped to. I'm much more of like a melody lyrics person. And Lucinda allowed that rhythm and groove to be melded with poetry. Because to me, like, and one of the reasons I love your music so much is that there is something interesting being said. It's not like, hey there, baby, don't say maybe. It's specific and it's really interesting and it's funny and it's multi-layered. And I think that's what kept me in the Lucinda world, was the lyrics and the literary nature of what she does. I mean, I was talking to somebody the other day and they were like, you know, I think Lucinda Williams is a poet with poetry set to music. I think it's maybe a little oversimplified, but she is one of those, I would say, rare songwriters that whose lyrics do, after she made a few albums, they do stand on their own. Car Wheels on a Gravel Road is, the lyrics and the stories held within it are sort of almost like these little Southern Gothic short stories that you're able to hear. They're not stock. They're not stock. So I want to ask you about, how do you think about lyrics related to your music?
Well, one of the things that we should point out is that Lucinda's a fantastic singer. Mm-hmm. And has a great voice, you know. I mean, and she just oozes, you know, style and character, you know. So, you know, that's also part of it. I mean, I think those early records when she was playing covers, they're cool. I would never underestimate her as a singer, you know. I think there's all these tropes about singer-songwriters, like, well, they're just doing the work and, you know, that they're not real singers or whatever, you know. So I don't know. I mean, know where we're going with any of that. But, I mean, I co-write a lot. I have an internal, I just have taste, you know, in terms of, oh, that's cool, that's not cool. Or mm-hmm. I like that. That's got me excited. I don't know why or whatever. And you know, I mean, when I was young, I wrote a lot of my Baby Done Left Me songs and, you know, whatever, something I worked through. I mean, I like writing songs and, you know, I mean, if I'm lucky enough to write one or drag somebody in the room to help me write it, I get pretty happy when it's finished until I get depressed because I don't know where the next one's coming from. So, that's been about it. I mean, I wanted to ask you, something about Lucinda, and that is she has this kind of perfectionist, unfairly put on her. And, you know, she was really of the school of, you know, I will serve no wine before it's time. And that's much the story behind Car Wheels, is that she held out until she was happy with it. And we're all the better because of it. I just want to know whether you feel like you're too hard on yourself or whether you're not hard enough on yourself. Because I think Lucinda was hard on herself, you know. But from that came great art.
I would say, for me at least, in terms of being perfectionistic, hard on yourself, it doesn't come, it definitely happens, but it doesn't come to me in the form of the songwriting, I would say. Like, I take songwriting really, really seriously, and I work really hard on my songs, and I do continuously edit them, and I look back and, of course, always wish that I'd done something a little bit better. But I think my perfectionism, unfortunately, comes more in the form of the way I manage how it's put into the world. I think so much about how to share the music and so much about how a show goes and why people came and why they didn't come and why they laughed and why they didn't laugh. And I think I'm a little more perfectionistic on that side, which I'm trying to ameliorate. And I think a big thing that I talked about in the podcast is that when I started playing music, I was surrounded by really successful musicians. You know, I was getting to meet people who worked with Emmylou Harris and getting people to meet people who worked with Lucinda Williams, things like that. And so the standard for where you could go with it was so high. I innately have a high standard for what I make as an artist, and that doesn't bother me. And like, that's the thing that doesn't stress me out. But the part of how do I fit into the music culture? How do I fit in the culture at large? How does the way people react reflect on whether I'm innately good enough or not? That's more of my challenge that I've faced, I would say.
Right. You know, speaking of Lucinda and her poetry, I mean, I still think poems are poems and songs are songs, you know, but I understand what you're saying, you know. In terms of her poetry, you know, when we were on tour that summer, I do remember one night we were in Fort Worth, Texas, and we were playing like at the Opera House or something. It was something different about the night. And Lucinda, for some reason, started opening up about songs and talking more than she really had on the tour. And she said, oh, I wrote this song. I was living in Houston and down the road from here. And this is called I Lost It, you know. And she said, at that time, everybody had those bumper stickers, which was kind of a Christian thing. And I found it. And she said, yeah, I just, you know, took off from that and wrote this song, you know, I Lost It. And it was really, really interesting. And then one night, I think she was talking about her dad. She had a song and it had a pale blue dress in it. And Lucinda's dad, this is like the one time he made a suggestion. He goes, I'd go with sad blue dress. I wonder, Lucinda is known for being, for saying that her dad may have been her toughest critic, besides herself, of course. I wonder how you feel about bouncing things off, like maybe your dad, or do you have people that you bounce things off, or are you discovering what I like to call the courage of your convictions, you know?
Yeah.
Who do you trust?
Who do I trust? Yeah. Well, I definitely trust you. I mean, I've sent you some of my music.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't send it with the expectation that you need to make any comments, because I've only really sent you finished things. But actually, that's not true. I've sent you works in progress. I would say, yeah, I'm really particular about who I share my work with. I would say I expanded it over time. Like in the beginning, I kind of kept it private, and then I would have a producer on a record and I would say, what do you think about this? And they would sort of give feedback. And I always wanted more feedback, but I wanted to wait for the right person. And a lot of producers and other musicians, they don't want to hurt you, and that's a great impulse, but they don't want to hurt your feelings. And so they're testing the waters. And I honestly, over the records and up until recently, I was always seeking someone that could be a little bit more like, eh, don't say that. And when I recently made a record last fall, I finally was able to find someone. There was enough of a shared, you know, language and enough of a trust where there was a word in a song. I used this word therapist, and it was like, he's like, eh, I don't like that. And I was like, me neither. So I found people. And then additionally, when I started kind of writing poetry for like a practice thing, I took these online poetry classes. Mm. I did get feedback from my classmates, and then I found this one poetry teacher who I paid a little bit of money, and I would send her my poetry, she would send it back. And then just recently, with this last record, I started sending her songs, which is totally different because she didn't know me as a songwriter at all. And she really helped me with understanding. I might write a lyric and be like, this is how I think it comes across. And then she listens and is like, that's not how I hear it. And it's not a critical way. It's more just like,
not how I hear it.
Yeah. And it's more like just understanding people perceive things in a way that sometimes you want to stand your ground and be like, this is what I have to say. But sometimes you do want to be really willing to be like, oh, that is not what I intended. So for example, I wrote a poem that's never been turned into a song, but it's about looking in my rearview mirror in my car and seeing this grown man with this burly arm covered in tattoos just waving his hand in the wind on the highway. It's sort of like a childish thing that we do that's very, I don't know, tactile, and reminds me of being a little kid. And I just saw this grown man doing it, and I wrote a poem about it. But then the problem was I called the poem Fingers in the Wind. And she was like, that sounds like a Halloween, like fingers flying through the wind thing.
Yeah.
And I was like, whoa, thank you, because that's literally could not be farther from what I was trying to convey. So definitely gotten feedback, but it's a process of learning how, who, the trust. And also the last thing you need is getting feedback from someone whose taste you don't like. That's the worst. You really want to avoid that.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And it's hard to find producers, you know, that are a good fit. And when we talk about art, I mean, I think one of the things that I think you've benefited from is that you were just exposed to a lot of great stuff, you know, and not everybody is, you know. That's probably the biggest gift you could have gotten, you know. I know Lucinda was exposed to great music and poetry around her house growing up, and you know, thanks to her dad and stuff. And her mother played piano. I think she's mentioned that before. So, you know, you've been exposed to a lot of great music because of your family. But in a way, these, you know, returning headliners for the festival are from another generation, you know. And so I'm interested in where the music's going, you know. I'm interested in what you're doing, you know, what you're bringing to it that might be different, you know. That's why I get excited when I see somebody like Jinx Lennon online or something. But being exposed to things now more than ever is you know, there's so much possibilities. There's so much great stuff out there.
A question that I have is about perseverance as an artist. Lucinda had it. You have it. I'm seeing if I have it day by day. What has that meant to you in your life?
For me, a lot of it has just been like the perseverance is just, you know, the fear of the day job. If I have a band and I want to keep it together, if I'm playing with musicians that I, you know, it's a lot. And making records has always come, you know, making records for me is generally the same process every time. It's basically being lucky enough to have like three songs maybe that I feel good about. Three songs that not only are good songs, but make me feel like I'm going somewhere I haven't been, and I can breathe life into them, and maybe I'll get four songs, and, you know, something fast, something slow, you know, and I start, and that's how I know that I'm, when I get up and I'm excited, I'm like, man, I'm excited about those songs, and I'm excited about, like, the sounds and what I'm doing at the moment, you know, and if I can keep that going, maybe I'll get enough songs that I can get excited about going into the studio and making a record. And if I can make a record, maybe I can get some musicians together and we can go out and play, you know. So that's the thing. That's the perseverance. I think that there's so much emphasis these days on, like, well, making it, and what does it mean to make it? I love Mary when she talks about the next level. What is the next level? Unicorns, butterflies? And I love when she says that, because what is it? And I agree. But what people don't talk about in terms of fears, my fear is that something's going to come along and make me stop. You know, my health. Somebody says, you know, Chuck, the last record did so poorly, we really can't give you any money for another one, you know, or we can only give you this much, or it's like, you know, the universe saying, stop. And that's my fear, you know, because I like my job, you know, I like the audience, I like traveling, I like, you know, meeting people out there, I like doing things like what, you know, we just did together between the film and the presentation of it at the Women's Club here in Chico, and talking to you and talking to another artist about our process. I mean, I generally like it all, you know. I like, you know.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Finding Lucinda. To finish this out, I'm going to share a little bit of audio from our show in Chico, California. This is me and Chuck playing Jackson. If you want to find out about coming to one of our tour dates, listen to the soundtrack, check out the film or the podcast, just go to findinglucinda.com. See you next time.
You check some.